This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to The Morning Run. I'm Roshan Kanesan with Noel Lim in the studio this morning. And just before we kick off the rest of the show and get into serious business and the like, bit of breaking news half an hour ago, Bayern Munich clinched the Champions League, beating a PSG 1-0 to make it their sixth European championship.
Right, of course, I need to let you have your airtime. I'm going to ask a noob question, though. When was the last time they won the championship? And were the footballers, did they wear a face mask when they played?
So to question number two, no, they did not, but it was an empty stadium. So it's a bit weird to watch. And number one, I can't tell you, actually. I'm not sure, but they have won it quite often in the last few years. Bayern Munich has been quite dominant in the Champions League state, whereas PSG has not been really. And it's also been a very interesting take on the competition, because normally it would be done and dusted by now. But over the when it came to the quarterfinals onwards, what they did was they brought everybody to Lisbon, and they did it all in like a spate of 2 weeks. So it was very interesting to see. It's very different from how it would normally go down. I'm not sure whether this is going to be the game, how it's going to be played going forward, but it is an interesting take on it. But yes, Bayern Munich once again champions of Europe. And yes, of course, I'm covering this because it is breaking news after
yes,
all.
Yes, of course. Anyway, congratulations to them.
Well, let's get on to the rest of the show and let's take a look at what's going on. In pivot to international news, we'll be taking a look at the U.S. as they passed $25 billion in bailouts for the U.S. Postal Service, as well as the California fires that are going out there. I think last headline I read was something like 1 million acres burned.
Yes, quite serious business. And we are also going to talk about Taylor Swift and Kanye West's divergent political paths. Not that I personally care, but I think many people will. So we are covering this.
I mean, what's more fun than talking about the divergent paths that Taylor Swift and Kanye West took in their lives? But right after this, we'll be taking a look at whether virtual meetings should stick around post-pandemic. Keep it here to BFM 89.9. Let us know what you think over on Twitter and WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Keep it here, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, welcome back to The Morning Run. I'm Roshan Kanesan with Noel Lim in the studio this morning. And that was The Way by Fastball off their second studio album, All the Pain Money Can Buy. I'm not sure I would want to buy any pain if money could buy it, actually. No, not at all.
No, not at all.
But you know what's got some people in a little bit of pain, though? All the virtual meetings that we've had to do in this pandemic era of life. But that said, you know, it's a lot of times this the virtual meetings and working remotely has become a double-edged sword. Before this, it was the minority that did remote working, right? So it was the majority culture was to work in the office, and often you had to push against a lot of against the grain, really, to work remotely, whether for whatever reason that was. But I guess there is the question now is, even when we get back to some form of normal or new normal or whatever that is, should virtual meetings stick around?
So this interesting piece of article by Fast Company, well, they make a case for, you know, if you have quite a number of remote workers, it makes sense to actually continue having virtual meetings so that you put remote workers on equal footing with their office working colleagues. So I think this, I think it just makes sense, right? If you have remote workers, and I think, you know, and you need them to be in a meeting, so obviously virtual makes sense. But I just want to add this about remote workers. They don't actually need to be just freelance. They could be people who actually just work in different towns, different cities, different countries, and you know, different time zones even. So yeah, so virtual obviously is the most practical option. However, if you don't actually have remote workers, what do you do, right? I feel that's a yes and no situation.
If you don't have remote workers and we all go back to the office, right? I think
and whether we should continue with virtual meetings.
I think it's important not to abandon the things we've learned, right? Because this is all just about learning about hybrid situations. Because what it's allowed us to do now is, the flexibility now is we really can't use it right now. But if we can learn this flexibility into the way we work, and culturally it becomes more acceptable for people to work from home as and when needed without having to explain 700 different things of why you're doing that. I think that's the cultural shift that's important. And right now, of course, it's getting painful and irritating and sometimes, quite frankly, isolating to be away from the team or even just the social setting of the office. It is important to not forget these things. There's ways we can improve the situation. We don't have to do all the painful things, but there are ways to adopt the lessons that we've learned, like communicating better online, digitally, virtually, whether it's text or typing or whatever, there are ways that we can carry this forward. We shouldn't forget all of this.
Yeah, so, you know, in some offices, it's quite, they occupy different floors, right? So some people actually have to take a lift, go down to another floor, and then there's the hassle of booking meeting rooms. It can be quite tedious, actually. And you have like a, you know, a plethora of administrative staff who actually have to do this for you. So really, it can be very practical to now just do it virtually, even if that your colleague is just sitting upstairs. And so so I think also, but it much depends on the purpose of the meeting. Obviously, difficult conversations need to be done face-to-face. Even something to say congratulations or celebrate birthdays, right? And also, well, purpose is one, the importance then of that meeting, if it's a decisions that you have to make, key decisions, and obviously face-to-face, and also the length of the meeting.
Oh.
I mean, you can't do 3-hour meetings online.
Yeah, no, I don't think that's the best thing to do. But, you know, I mean, this is not to replace the face-to-face, right? Because that's still very important, at least for our generation or this generation of people, that face-to-face still has a root in the way we work and live and all of that. But it is. There are ways that we can take it forward, and the way that we can, I guess, communicate in terms of, because right now the workforces are distributed, right? Because not everyone necessarily works in the same office. But if we can adopt the same mixer sort of situation of just like, oh, we're going to do a virtual hangout situation here and play a few games. Join if you can. If those things can keep going on, because, like you said, Noel, some workers work on the different floors. This is a great way of digitally mixing some of your workers around, getting them to know each other from different divisions, and fostering a bit of, I don't know, camaraderie through the virtual era in a way. Basically, all the pluses of going online, right? This was the idealistic, optimistic situation when we talk about the internet. There is still ways to do it. We just have to curate it and, I guess, grow it.
Yeah, so this article also does point out to some things like, you know, some of the downside of having virtual meetings. For example, people who tend to be a bit more quiet may stay even more quiet now. Even more silent, right? So I think probably as the person who's hosting the meeting or facilitating the meeting, just has to be more mindful about this, maybe giving them more airtime or trying to have some sort of rules of engagement, some protocol in place to say, okay, make sure everyone have equal airtime.
Yeah, or just have easier ways, reduce, decrease the hurdle requirement to speak, right? If it's sometimes it's just in a casual in-person conversation, is really who speaks the loudest, right? Or who commands a certain air of authority, whether by virtue of social circle or by the formalized setting.
It's just the voice itself, the way they project itself, the voice.
Right? But then, you know, things like, you know, like Zoom meetings has like raise hands and things like that. So I've been doing some webinars off and on with Malik, who's the BFM founder. And although it sometimes does look weird, the way we convey that we want to say something is we put up our hand and it says a little hand in the corner. And immediately I'm like, okay, all right, Malik wants to say something or the guest wants to say something. Because to overlap your voices on a webinar is incredibly, it's an ugly audio experience because you're not hearing anything.
Yes, and you do not know then who's going to speak next.
Yes, it's also very awkward, right? Because there's a slight lag. No matter how good your internet is and how great the services have come, there is still a slight lag of half a second, 1 second. And it's that half a second, 1 second, it creates really awkward instances because we both talk at the same time. And then we're like, oh, okay, I should take a step back. And we both take a step back at the same time. And
it's
then
always just, like that. We're trying to be nice to each other.
Silence, right? So it is a... Once in a while, it's awkward and funny. If it gets too often, it's just frustrating and irritating.
And another thing, though, you know, this thing about switching on or switching off the video, I think that's something that people also, you know, teams also need to decide what's the best way forward.
Yeah, because, I mean, overall, there have been benefits. And like to anything, right, it's like it's a double-edged sword. The remote working situation that we're in has led to many people to virtual meeting fatigue and in some studies promoting longer working hours because there are no real legit ends to the day and no legit starts, right? So that's why things like I guess digital hygiene, things like a virtual check-in in the morning just to start the day, like officially, okay, we've started the work day, and a kind of maybe a closing off email or something. These are things that I think we're all just trying to figure out how it plays into the way we work. And that's just the ongoing situation, right? Yes, Noel, I think you thought I was going to say work and live. I'm going to try and avoid saying that for now at very least. But we're going into a few messages. And when we come back, we'll be talking about basically, can celebrities afford to be apolitical in this era of political polarization? Let us know what you think over on Twitter at BFM Radio or over on WhatsApp at 018 8899. Keep it here to BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, we're not an American band, but that was the song by Grand Funk Railroad off their first single back in 1973, way, way before I was ever born. And right now we're taking a look at the political, actually we're taking a look at politics and music in America right now, and how we've seen basically apoliticalism, if that's a word, is no longer a choice. Even the most staunch of apolitical prominent pop stars like Taylor Swift was for many, many years, have become political in nature. And I think the article we're taking a look at, I think shows compares Taylor Swift and Kanye West, right? And Taylor Swift, for all intents and purposes, for many years was apolitical, whereas, and that was the genre of the music that allowed her to do that. Whereas hip-hop and Kanye West, or at least the hip-hop that they were involved in, hip-hop by nature was not apolitical, right? It was very anti-establishment, very anti-Republican at the time, and basically of calling out the systemic racism that they've or seem to be still facing till today. So it is very interesting to see how the role of celebrities and the polarization around that has led to the situation that we are in right now.
Yeah, to put this in perspective, I think politics in the US has become more divisive than ever. You know, you have families who are actually very divided on who they want to support. It's becoming very personal, from what I understand among my American friends. That's what they tell me. So I can imagine eventually celebrities would start getting involved. And just to just take a look at how powerful celebrities can be. So Barack Obama, in 2008, the Democratic presidential primary elections, one study by the University of Maryland showed that Oprah Winfrey was very influential in helping him pull over votes, and they estimate something like more than 1 million votes went swung to him, so which could be obviously very significant for him. And but the same study found that celebrities were not particularly influential on first-time voters after 2004. And that could be because of the global financial crisis. A lot of first-time voters might have been really severely impacted. They couldn't get jobs. So, they became very influenced by what was going on around them and by their family and friends. So then as a result, what they have found, for example, celebrities have endorsed some politicians like Beyonce, Rihanna, Taylor Swift even. And they found they were actually not very successful in they endorsed some of these politicians, but these politicians actually never won. So, which was interesting. But having said that, there is a disclaimer that the people that they supported, that they endorsed, were in states that were very hardcore Republicans.
They weren't the incumbents, right? So yes. It was really an uphill battle from then. And the fact that the endorsements gave these other candidates a fighting chance in those races is significant. And I think the point here is that it really is about the power. So let's talk about Oprah Winfrey, right? Who was the queen of daytime television in the US in the 90s. So her influence is phenomenal, right? If she ran for president, it would be a very interesting situation. But a lot of celebrities don't do that because their influence is confined to one particular area, which is what they've been pigeonholed into believing, or what they've been pigeonholed the situation, right? But she grew so much influence, and the target demographic of her daytime TV show primarily women, but it spanned demographics, right? Which makes her voice very powerful, and that leads credibility to the power of an endorsement. Right now, whose endorsement are we talking about? How big is this celebrity? And arguably, Taylor Swift is one of the biggest pop stars in the world today, and she's mostly been apolitical for a very long time, until maybe the 2016 election, where she just encouraged people to vote. It was only until the 2018 midterm elections that she finally actually took a stand for one particular political angle, right? But in and amongst all of this, there is the self-serving nature of it that we need to talk about, because is it a calculated move, right? We've seen brands like Nike support Colin Kaepernick, right? But there is always an argument that Nike has done the numbers and there are more Democrats who buy shoes than Republicans that buy shoes, just based on socioeconomic data and all of that. So there is always going to be that in the back of anyone's mind, right?
Yeah, so I think that self-serving agenda, we can't dismiss that. So I think some people are able to see that. I do not know how many people will be able to see through that. But one study by, I think, University of Ohio. I'm sorry, I'm quoting like university studies, right? How interesting. But anyway, to put some statistics behind this, they found that people are more likely to listen to celebrities who have had history in civil rights. So, you know, Oprah, she talks a lot about mm-hmm. the little man, right, for the little man. So she has that credibility in that sense. And I think Taylor Swift, among the young people, I mean, she's lent a name to a number of philanthropy causes. I'm not sure about Kanye West. I mean, but I have to say, you know, these two stars are really not my generation. Yeah. Would they influence me in voting? No. Would Siti Nurhaliza, for example, in Malaysia, influence me in my voting? No. So, but I don't tend to be very influenced by celebrities.
I'm actually thinking back, if I was 14 years old again, or 15 or 16 or whatever, and Joe Flizzo had said something about the political nature of Malaysia, it might have influenced me for many years, because it's also just the messaging. That's why mass messaging is so important, right? That's, people don't spend money on billboards and advertising for no reason. Even if you think you are inoculated from branding, no one's really inoculated from branding. It may take a little while longer on you. But Kanye West is an interesting character, because he was very anti-Bush back in the day. And I think he generally is a contrarian in a lot of ways, right? It's always about, and at that point, it was a Republican-dominated political landscape, and he was contrarian to that with Jay-Z at that point. And hip-hop was very against the social injustices of the day at that point. And now he switched over to a Donald Trump supporter. But at the same time, he has changed significantly as an artist over the last 20 years, right? So even as an individual, I think we cannot discount the fact that people do change.
And, yes, yeah.
And to Kanye's story, he's also been very unstable over the last few years, and he's cited his own mental health issues. So we don't really know how he really thinks today, right? Actually, you don't know how anyone really thinks, especially celebrity, because a lot of times, especially today with the industrial complex the way it is, a lot of these identities are curated in a certain manner.
Yeah, so it's a lot of brainwashing that's going on.
That is a very that is the line to end on right now. And we're going into a few messages. When we come back, we'll take a look at the international stories. But right now, we're going into the 6:30 a.m. news bulletin. And to take you there, heading for the light by the Travelling Wilburys. Keep it here to BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, welcome back to The Morning Run. That was That's Not My Name by the Ting Tings. And right now, we're taking a look at international news, starting and primarily focusing on the U.S. House passing a $25 billion bailout plan for the U.S. Postal Service. Now, while this may sound like good news, I think it's we should acknowledge early on this is likely to die in the Republican-controlled Senate, even though around 26 Republicans in Congress did break ranks to vote for this bill. And this is obviously surrounding the talk around how important mail-in votes are going to be for this year's U.S. presidential election, or actually just in general, I think, in this COVID-19 era, how important mail-in votes are going to be. And basically, the optics around it looks like the U.S. Postmaster General has been kneecapping the U.S. Postal Service.
Yeah, so I think what Democratic leaders are saying that, you know, they go back to what Trump apparently has done, which included cutting overtime for employees, limiting post office hours, and removing some high-volume mail sorting machines from USPS facilities. And so, like what you said, the Democrats argue that, you know, these policies will obviously impede mail-in voting ahead of the November elections, especially in this COVID-19 situation. And so, obviously, they want to push this bill. But, you know, Donald Trump, of course, has denied these claims, saying that the changes were actually intended to increase efficiency and save money. But, you know, cutting overtime money seems like not really the best thing to do, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you take a wider view, it's kind of the entire situation around the postal services everywhere, right? I think we see parallels here in Malaysia as well. Now, while packages overall have increased because of e-commerce, letters and mail have decreased significantly. I think anyone who lived in the 90s who takes a look at their post box today and back then, it's two very different stories. So what Louis DeJoy, who is the U.S. Postmaster General, argues is that this was all part of a rationalization exercise, right? It's how to make it more efficient, there's less mail, you don't need as many mail sorting machines, etc., etc., etc. Now, the problem is, optically, it looks bad. So whatever the reasoning is, maybe he's right. Maybe it was, in fact, planned in advance. But the fact is, you're in an unprecedented time where mail-in votes are possibly going to be more important than they've ever been before in U.S. elections. And you have a president who's seemingly very anti-postal votes. So all of it plays into a narrative that looks bad for the Republicans and the presidency.
Yeah, so I think obviously there must be some provisions here to make allowance for the fact there will be an elections, there will be mail-in voting, and more resources will have to be devoted stuff, you know, during that time.
Yeah, and I think it just, it's depressing to hear that, you know, the backlog here that we see, right? So the Congress passed this vote by 257 to 150. That's more than a simple majority. But now it's going to go to the Senate, where it will die because it's controlled by the Republicans. And then the question in my mind comes up, what is the point of the Senate? Because it, if you look back at U.S. history and politics and all of that, it's argued that the Senate represents minority interests, you know, but it's what type of minority we're talking about. We're talking about political minorities. So you have a minority of political interests in the U.S. who are able to kneecap any form of legislation that goes through the House, go through Congress. And on top of that, you've got veto power in the presidency, right? And that's always been the case. So what is the point of the U.S. Senate?
Yeah, so I think, you know, when this whole system was originally designed, it's probably meant to provide some check and balances, but no system is perfect.
No system is perfect. And it is going to be, this is just part of the, this leads to the whole narrative around that politics doesn't work, right? Because you can have such a big majority in the House, yet it'll die in the Senate because of a simple majority. And essentially, nothing gets moving.
So, you mean like democracy does not work?
Or this form of democracy doesn't work, right? Because you already have. So Congress members are voted in by their districts. So this is technically the voice of the people. This is of those people anyway. But this is going to be something that's going to be covered ongoing. The November elections are just a few months away. November, the second week, second Tuesday of November, the U.S. presidential elections are going to be are going to be highly watched as they always are. Now, let us know what you think over on Twitter at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us in at 018-789-8899. Up next, the local papers and the portals. Keep it here to BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, welcome back to The Morning Run. I'm Roshi Kanesan with Noel Lim in the studio this morning. And right now we're taking a look at the local papers and the portals. And I think we're going to start with the New Straits Times, which Noel has opened in front of her.
Yes, so New Straits Times here, they have this big piece on mask pollution. You might notice as you walk along the streets, people are just throwing their mask, like, you know, how they might throw rubbish on the streets. And that's really not helpful at all. So experts have warned of face mask pollution. They say improper disposal of masks threaten humans and the environment because, you know, it could, you know, carry a virus. And then and because we know the pandemic has led to a surge in the use of single-use face masks, I think that's the kind of mask that you usually find being thrown around, you know, on the streets and all that. But, you know, there's one Penang family that NSD has pointed out. They are, you know, doing ordinary Malaysians, doing they are doing things in a rather extraordinary way because this family is collecting all the masks that have been thrown on the ground and they have been trying to make sure they are properly disposed.
That's a nice story to add that to, because oftentimes it just sounds like doom and gloom, right? Yeah, like people just throw things away. And I mean, there's only so much we can do, right? We educate, we try to call things out. But you still see these masks all over the place. And the thing is with mask pollution, because they're so light, they just fly all over the place. So even if you dispose them consciously into a bin, if you don't dispose them properly, they could fly out of the bin, right? Because there's nothing really weighing that thing down. If I take a look at some of the online portals, it's all really around some headlines out of Bersatu. They have who had their party elections for the top post, right? And no surprises that Tan Sri Mudinasin has remained the president of the party and they've elected a bunch of the other top posts. But one of the particular things that came out was the fact that they're trying to create this narrative or trying to open up this narrative of multiculturalism in Bersatu. So there is this new thing that they're saying, hey, we're going to, Bersatu already has non-Malay members, but before this it was non-voting rights and you couldn't compete for top posts. But now they want to head towards a situation where Bersatu would be multicultural. Now, branding-wise, I don't know how this is going to go because they've always branded themselves as Bumiputra. It's in the name. But how they're going to take this forward, is this in a way trying to compete with the multicultural narrative that PKR has had for 20 years?
And also UMNO, MCA and MIC?
Yeah, that's a complicated situation, right?
Because, yes, of course. But you know, yeah, so I maybe it's a way for Muhyiddin to differentiate himself, to differentiate his party. Or maybe it's his way of, you know, saying I'm the prime minister of all races, right? And not just one race. And well, speaking about Muhyiddin, the Star has a piece here. He's going to announce the registration status of Perikatan Nasional. And so there are right now, I think, five parties registered in the coalition, Bersatu, PAS, and component parties from Barisan Nasional. He, however, noted that not the entire Barisan coalition is still with Perikatan yet. So, you know, we just have to wait and see what will happen. But I think more interestingly is Bersatu says they will want to discuss Azmin's position mm-hmm. in Bersatu, right? What role is he going to play?
Yeah, because they've had the election, so they've appointed all the top posts right when he's joined. So he can't even compete for anything there. You know, normally you would have you have three VP spots, right? So those are, like, if you look at all the VP spots right now, they're all ministers or deputy ministers representing their status in the current government. Azmin is a senior minister, Dato' Azmin Ali. He's a senior minister and for all intents and purposes, de facto deputy when when Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin is not around. So now he's in Bersatu with no real post. What does that really mean for his political power within the party? I mean, this multicultural element here seems to be something that he's trying to rally around as well, because he's got non-Malay supporters, right? So whether this jives with the party overall is going to be an interesting thing to watch.
Yeah, and although he actually has no formal position in Bersatu, he has been speaking on behalf of Bersatu, and he was the one who said Muhyiddin will announce the registration status of Perikatan Nasional. And I suppose if he's senior minister, maybe they will have to create a senior VP post for him. But I guess that depends on the constitution of the party.
Consultant VP, maybe. Who knows?
Some advisor.
Senator VP. You know, something outside the elected nature of the party. But, you know, when we talk about this multiculturalism, or there is one appointment, one member who won a VP post, Dato' Sri Ronald Kiandi, who is a non-Muslim. So he's, I think this lends to this narrative of the non-Muslim nature of Bersatu, or where they're trying to pivot. Because everything we've talked about over the last few weeks comes to this point, right? How does Bersatu today differ from UMNO? Because they largely compete for the same basis. I mean, UMNO and PAS have very distinct differences. PKR and UMNO and PAS all have their electorate. But Bersatu was formed in a protest of UMNO. And those protesters are no longer part of Bersatu. So how does that, where is Bersatu's identity? Maybe this is what they're trying to do.
Yes, and maybe Azmin will become president of Bersatu, who knows? yeah, well, anything is possible in today's politics. But just very quickly, I think, you know, social media has been so busy on Khairuddin, right? Datuk Dr. Muhammad Khairuddin Ahmad Razali, who's the Plantation Industries and Commodities Minister. He's really been hot soup, at least from the social media point of view. You know, he's going to be under probe by the police for breaking the quarantine rules. That's the latest now.
Yeah, that really broke out over the weekend. I think the news came out on Saturday that he essentially broke quarantine rules, and because he was a minister and he had things to do, and he had been tested and he had done his test for COVID-19 and didn't see any
results were negative. But anyone who's tested negative
correct.
Will still have to quarantine.
So this again highlights the disparity that we're seeing in some rules and regulations and SOPs. Right now, we're going into a few messages and then 7 a.m. news bulletin. We'll take you there, Here and Now by Letters to Cleo. Stay tuned to BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.